It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. Hope the weekend was good. I'm Mark Bayshore. As you've been hearing all morning on WKAR, Michigan will recount its presidential votes beginning at noon today. Earlier this morning, I spoke with the person overseeing the recount here in Ingham County, Clerk Barb Byram. I first asked her about her priorities hours before the recount is set to begin.
So right now, we are waking people up with a phone call, trying to schedule them to serve as recount workers on behalf of the Ingham County Clerk's Office.
Do you feel like you'll get the human resources that you need?
I certainly hope so. We have been contacted by well over 500 individuals expressing their interest. I have made a strong effort to have Democrats and Republicans to have it balanced so that each two-member team has a Democrat and a Republican performing the recount.
How many people do you need? How many people would you like to have here?
I would like to have 30 two-member teams, so that's going to be at least 60 people, plus I'll have some team leaders to help organize everyone.
Are you confident you'll get those 60 people?
I am reasonably confident that we will have all of the individuals necessary. You know, this is a quick turnaround. You know, we got the order from the judge a little after midnight this morning. No one was responding to my text messages at 12:30 this morning, which is unfortunate. But now we are calling people this morning to see if they're still interested in working the recount, and if so, to schedule them.
And your charge is to wrap up work by when?
I would like to be done within 6 days, so that's a lofty goal, but I think it might be attainable if we are fortunate enough to have 32-member teams working.
And how many votes need to be recounted?
We're going to be recounting all of the ballots voted, so it's going to be over 130,000 ballots that will be hand-recounted.
This will be happening where?
This will be at the Ingham County Fairgrounds Main Arena. So it's where I used to show sheep. We'll now be counting votes.
Counting sheep to counting votes. Is there any, if there are listeners who are interested in participating, would you like to hear from more people, or do you feel that the list of names you've got now will suffice?
Right now, I believe I have been contacted by enough individuals that wish to work the recount, and I would encourage people to watch and listen. But right now, I think I have enough workers available.
Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram here on WKAR's Current State. Well, efforts have begun in DeWitt to address ethnically charged school incidents that followed last month's presidential election. Within a few days, school officials referred to at least three incidents involving harassment of and comments toward Hispanic students back on Wednesday, November 9th. School administrators have announced several actions, including disciplinary measures and focus groups involving ethnic toleration and respect. Meanwhile, the Lansing State Journal said the conversation about the incidents at a public gathering last week at DeWitt High School became heated. So how does a school and community constructively respond to such incidents? We have two guests today to help us sort through that. Dr. Dorinda Carter-Andrews is an expert on the role of race in educational outcomes. She's worked with school districts on these issues and is an associate professor in Michigan State's Department of Teacher Education. Welcome back to WKAR.
Thank you, Mark.
And Dr. Tara VanZant Chambers studies academic achievement and school engagement with a focus on minority students. She's an associate professor of K-12 Education Administration. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dorinda Carter-Andrews, I understand that several people in DeWitt have reached out to you following these incidents. Have you become involved with the follow-up to these at DeWitt?
Not as of late, Mark. I have been contacted by the superintendent and also by a teacher, but it's kind of been a back and forth as of yet, and so I haven't been able to actually have a conversation with the superintendent of
DeWitt. Would you like to get involved?
Absolutely. I have a history with the district and would love to kind of rekindle that relationship and help them work through these issues.
I mean, in one incident, apparently a group of male, presumably white students, locked arms and prevented some number of other students from passing. We're led to believe at least one Hispanic girl was unable to get to her locker. In another, students, and I'm quoting here, commented about minority students, unquote. I want to ask you both, these were not the only school incidents like this to happen in the days following the election. Generally, Tara, what did you make of this uptick?
Sure. Well, you know, I think several things. First, you know, I think this reflects the fact that it's difficult to separate politics and current events from what happens in schools. Kids know about these things, they're affected by them, and they talk about what's happening in the world. And so teachers and other school leaders need to be prepared to have these conversations, regardless of what their personal viewpoints might be. I also hear people say that folks feel emboldened to say or to act in particular ways. I think that's part of it. And the difficult part of what's happening right now, at least for school personnel, is that the things that are being said about many minoritized groups in the United States run in counter or direct kind of the things that we teach children in school about respect for others. And I think that's a difficult thing for people to navigate. So is there an uptick? Maybe. I'm in contact with school folks every day. And on any given day, they're working through a lot of different challenging or important issues. And sometimes there's a window with what gets taken up right now. And for good reason, our focus is on this kind of issue.
In various statements, DeWitt school administrators have said the following here. The students involved have been disciplined according to our code of conduct for ethnic harassment. Teachers spent several days in their classrooms covering tolerance and respect, and that those lessons would continue, and that longer-term focus groups would be created to address these issues, quote, on a larger scale. Dorinda, all of these measures sound appropriate. What do you make of them?
Well, I think you're right. They sound appropriate, but I think we first have to ask, how are you framing the issue? And one thing to think about, Mark, is are these teachers confident in actually facilitating these types of dialogues with young people? Are they skilled to do that? Do they have the necessary tools in their own kind of teacher toolkit to do that? And framing is really important. So even using the language of how do we teach tolerance can send a certain type of message
right.
to young people and family. So what are you saying? Do I have to be tolerated? As opposed to how do we help young people understand how to respect and affirm diverse people, individuals, and families. So I think for one ways in which schools can think about this is really focus on how they frame the dialogue and the issues, because who wants to be tolerated in a learning space when they can have an opportunity to actually be affirmed and celebrated? And then secondly, are teachers actually adequately skilled to engage discussions about inequity, difference, privilege, power? Probably all of the teachers in DeWitt are not. And so a very first next step is to help those teachers acquire that training.
To what extent do we take into consideration the ages of the kids involved? These are seventh and eighth graders. There are a lot of really great, commendable young kids of that age, but it's also an age where there can be an awful lot of mischief. You hear some people say, "Hey, we need to understand, we need to move on and grapple with this constructively." It should be less about discipline, I think, than it should be about moving forward. How relevant are the ages of the kids in this?
You know, I think that this is a critically important issue. Even young children, though, can be engaged in appropriate conversations about respect for one another. I have a son who's in kindergarten, and my partner and I talk with him all the time about what's happening in the world. And those are hard conversations for us to have. We both have PhDs. It doesn't make it easier. But I'm encouraged to see that these conversations get easier with practice. And as kids get older, you can have more informed conversations. You're able to talk more specifically about these issues and bring other more complex issues into the conversation. So I'm encouraged that we can do this, and kids are going to be right there with us to have these conversations.
You know, addressing bullying has been a part of, you know, the school administrative landscape for quite a few years here now. Is there anything from the bullying conversation that can be used in these circumstances, Dorinda? What do you think?
I mean, I think that's a great question. You know, bullying regulations are not something that I'm up to date on, but I do think that we have to help children of all ages understand what's bullying, what's actual, you know, more specific forms of discrimination, racism, sexism, homophobia, and that bullying can, these things can be leveled, right? So you can verbally harass, but when does that turn into behavior, whether it's physical or verbal, that can have longer term consequences? And again, around the language we use, how do we name things for what they are? I think sometimes in schools, we will use language that's more comfortable for us. Kids understand what discrimination is and how people discriminate based on race, sexuality, gender, etc. And so talking to them about bullying is a start, but then naming things for what they are, because they see these things happening in the media, the larger society, and we don't call them bullying. We call them what they are, and young people need to have the language to actually nuance these things in their own lives.
Dr. Dorinda Carter-Andrews is an expert on the role of race in educational outcomes. She's on the faculty here at Michigan State University. Also, Dr. Tara Van Zandt Chambers studies academic achievement and school engagement with a focus on minority students. We're talking about efforts in the DeWitt School District to follow up on ethnically charged school incidents that followed last month's presidential election. The school seems to be taking the lead on this thing. Is it the school's responsibility to lead?
You know, I think the school has one role in leading, but I think parents and guardians have another role in leading. These conversations can't only take place in a school building. Kids are learning in all of their social spaces. And so to what degree are parents talking about issues of bias and discrimination and stereotypes at the dinner table, at the breakfast table? I think sometimes we feel like kids aren't ready to have these conversations. But there's a lot of research that shows they're already having them on the playground, mm-hmm. as early as preschool, as early as kindergarten. Kids are concerned with fairness and justice. And so it may be us adults who lack the confidence and courage to actually engage the discourse. So schools definitely should lead, but families need to be a part as well.
Well, it's interesting, though, you talk about the challenge of facilitating this conversation responsibly on the part of the faculty. Families have to navigate this conversation responsibly as well. It sounds very challenging.
Yeah.
And you alluded, Tara, to the fact that it happens in your family.
Yeah.
Yeah. To what extent should the larger community, I mean, we're talking about the school district and we're talking about families here. That's an awful lot of people. Who else needs to be a part of this conversation, would you say?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. And, you know, I personally believe that there's a lot of power in the community. In many ways, how a community responds to a particular incident when they happen, or in some cases, how a community doesn't respond, also says a lot about the culture of a community. Fortunately, we have a lot of examples in the nation right now of communities that have come together to counter hate crimes. And I think that that says a lot about what communities value. So there's a lot of power in the community response.
Do you ever think that the more, as a society, that we condemn harassment or racism, that the more some segments of society might be inclined to commit those very acts? It's highly irrational, but I wonder if that isn't, I sometimes wonder, this is very subjective thought of mine, I sometimes wonder if that isn't what's happening here.
You know, one thing I would say, Mark, is that these acts aren't new. We know as a nation historically these acts of violence against marginalized groups, marginalized bodies have happened. So I think we live, you know, in a time where we have more quick accessibility to these acts now through social media, through our smartphones, et cetera. But we have to remember as a nation that this is nothing new. And so we've been trying to condemn these acts historically and in a contemporary way while they simultaneously happen. So I think the fight for justice is just continual. And the more that the media is able to kind of illuminate them, we just see them surface more.
Anything to add to that,
Tara?
Yeah,
no, I think Dr. Carter-Andrews makes a great point. I would also say that, you know, in most of these situations, we're not dealing with evil people. It's certainly the case when we're talking about kids. I think instead, we're seeing a response that people don't feel heard or they feel ignored or they don't know how to make sense of the events that are happening and they respond inappropriately. So just to dismiss these acts out of hand as racist, although they may be, it misses an opportunity for us to have a conversation. But it's also true that these responses often are inappropriate and they may also be racist or xenophobic or whatever. And to me, it highlights the need for courses, for professional development, for student assemblies, all kinds of opportunities to talk about teaching and leading for diversity, for equity, for social justice. These are not just throwaway courses. You know, what we're seeing in the world today is clear proof that we, more proof than we could ever imagine that, you know, like we need these kinds of conversations to happen.
Dorinda Carter-Andrews, you were a featured speaker at a local TED Talk a few years ago at which you said, quote, "Schools never have, nor do they currently, prepare adults and young people to learn how to respect each other across cultural differences," unquote. And you suggested it's important to understand how power works. You alluded to power in an earlier answer. How power works if we want to eliminate educational achievement gaps. Can you identify something about how power works that it's important for people to know?
Absolutely. So if we think about issues of power in schooling, we can think about the curriculum as one explicit example. What gets taught, whose history gets taught, and through what lens, what narrative? That's about issues of power and who has control over writing the textbooks, whose voices get illuminated. That's one example. If we think about teacher hiring and how that happens, right? And where we see majority students of color in schools, but the teaching faculty is predominantly white. That is not just happenstance. We know there are gatekeeping mechanisms like the teacher certification test that make it hard for students with certain cultural backgrounds to perhaps pass those tests the first time. Not because they're inadequate, but the tests themselves have cultural nuances that test takers might not be familiar with. Those are just two concrete examples. One around curriculum, what kids have access to learn and through whose narrative, and then also around teacher hiring and retention that I can use to give examples for issues of power and how they play out in school.
I want to thank both of my guests, Dr. Dorinda Carter-Andrews, an expert on the role of race in educational outcomes, Dr. Tara VanZant Chambers studies academic achievement and school engagement with a focus on minority students. Both are on the faculty at Michigan State's College of Education. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Coming up on Current State, the Homeless Angels is moving from the former Magnuson Hotel in South Lansing to the Burkwood Inn in Lansing Township. We talk with founder Mike Carl at the new Homeless Angels facilities about the challenges ahead. That's later this hour on Current State. Well, The Rock on MSU's campus has been an important part of the university's history since the late 1800s. Today, it serves as a billboard of sorts for a great number of different student groups who paint over it on almost a daily basis. And over the years, the paint has really built up. So much so that a slab of The Rock recently fell off. And instead of disposing of it, the MSU surplus store and a local jeweler decided to make it into unique keepsakes called Spartan Agate. Joining us in the studio, our jeweler, Mel Swartz, the creator of Spartan Agate. Welcome, Mel.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
And also MSU Surplus Store Manager, Chris Jolly.
Hi.
Hi, Chris. Chris, let's talk about the history and tradition of the rock. Most people right around us know about it, but explain what it is.
Sure. The rock was donated to campus in 1873 by a group of students, their graduating class. It sat next to Beaumont Tower for several years. It was known as Engagement Rock at that time and was a good hot spot for romantic couples to meet up. And over the years, it became more of a place for political slogans and different type of student group advertisements, and it was moved to the auditorium area in 1985, I think. And has been there since. And
a lot of great photographs of couples sitting on the bench in front of the rock. What happens now at the rock?
The rock is painted almost daily. There's a lineup. I had a student group who wanted to paint it a couple weeks ago, and they had to sleep in overnight just to have a shot at it. So it's first come, first serve. Mm-hmm. I believe you have to register now to have a spot to be able to paint it.
And a piece of the rock recently fell off. What happened then?
It was a full, almost 2-inch thick sheet of paint that just kind of peeled off and fell on the ground. A staff member brought it to us and wanted to know if we could do something with it because we upcycle all sorts of different types of things. We weren't sure what to do with it, so that employee said, I know a person who would like to try to do something with it. Would you let her try? And I said, sure.
And that brings Mel Swartz into the picture. We'll post a picture on our website, but Mel, can you describe what these man-made gemstones look like?
Well, they're quite lovely. I imagine if you envision all the students painting the rock over the years, they use pretty much every color imaginable. So it's a beautiful banded-looking stone, even though it's man-made. It looks somewhat similar to fordite, which is a type of stone that came from the automobile industry in the painting bays for decades and decades. The cars used to be hand-painted, and the paint would accumulate on the racks and the tracks and the fixtures, and periodically they'd have to chip it off. And it's very hard because it's been baked over and over, and somewhere along the line someone found out you could handle it just like a lapidary material and cut it and shape it and polish it.
What do you have when you first start working with this? Chris described an inch thick.
Well, the pieces I received weren't quite that thick. It was just a few random pieces, just a few pounds. And it was initially quite soft and very gummy because, as Chris said, the students can't even paint it every night. And it's not using house paint, you know, oil and latex and a blend. And it's not really allowed to cure. And additionally, often it traps moisture between the layers because they paint rain or shine. And so when I received my piece, it was very, very kind of gummy and flexible and soft, not something you could imagine you could do something with. But I dried it in my sunroom basically for over a year, and that can get very hot, you know, if it's closed up. And it drove out as much moisture as possible and cured the paint, and then it became more easy to work with.
I'm speaking with Mel Swartz, a local jeweler who makes Spartan Agate out of a slab of paint that fell off the rock on the MSU campus. Also, Chris Jolly joins us, the manager of the MSU Surplus Store. Briefly, what kinds of jewelry are you creating with this?
Well, I received the paint actually a few years ago, and it dried for about a year. So I've been producing jewelry now, I would say, less than a year. At this time, I make necklaces, earrings. I have plans to make a few other items, you know, more men's type of items.
What colors do these things turn out to be? Because
every color you could possibly imagine.
You brought a few examples.
Yeah,
this
is some paint that's partially finished, but it's starting to reveal the layers and the colors, and possibly you can put that picture up on your
website.
Kind of
a smattering of different patterns and colors.
I mean, this is how it looks originally. Not very attractive.
Well, there's a lot of green and white in there, though, so I suppose
Predominantly.
You got a lot of green and white that ends up on the rock, I imagine.
But it's very colorful, every color you could imagine, and it's two-sided also.
Chris, what did you think when you first saw some of the finished product?
I thought it was great. Like I said, we're always looking at different ways of upcycling materials, and this is one of the more creative ones that I've seen. We really struggled for ideas on what to do, and I think they're pretty amazing looking when you see the jewelry.
We want to be clear that the rock and the paint on it are the property of MSU, and not just anyone can take a piece of it, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Are there any plans to ever intentionally make more of the rock available for these mementos?
All depends. The paint, this was the first time I've had a sheet fall off like that that anybody's given to me, so I have no idea on how frequent it happens. We'll see what happens. Mm. It doesn't get chipped, be clear. It just falls off naturally.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
Mel, where can people buy the jewelry?
Right now, the MSU Museum gift shop is carrying it, and they'll be at a special event tomorrow that Chris can probably tell you about better.
Yeah. What's going on, Chris?
Sure. Tomorrow at the surplus store from noon to 9 p.m., we have what we're calling the Shop Everything MSU sale. We have about 19 different vendors, retailers from campus who will have booths there for items that you can purchase, everything from MSU Museum to the dairy store, the meat lab, all different areas. So.
This is where I say it makes a great gift.
Yes, it does.
We want to thank both of our guests, Chris Jolly, the manager of the MSU Surplus Store, along with jeweler Mel Swartz, who makes Spartan agate. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on Current State, with a road win over the New Orleans Saints yesterday, the Lions have now won 7 of their last 8. If they keep up this pace, we could possibly see the Lions host their first playoff game since 1993. Current Sports host Al Martin talks about the likelihood. That's coming up on Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR, always at WKAR.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. Mike Carl is committed to helping the homeless of Lansing. His organization, the Homeless Angels, just wrapped up 2.5 years at the Magnuson Hotel on the South Side, providing shelter and opportunities to the homeless. The Homeless Angels are now sprucing up a new facility, and Scott Pohl paid a visit. Where are they now, Scott?
Well, it's the Birkwood Inn on Lansing Road, Mark. You might say the Homeless Angels have an angel of their own in the form of an anonymous donor, as you'll hear from founder Mike Carl. Our conversation began with the end of their former relationship with the Magnuson Hotel.
It was a great partnership. We worked with the manager of the hotel, the regional manager, to come up with innovative ways to try to get more rooms so that we could help more people. We understood that it helped him. We understood that we were making no money out of it, but the number of lives that changed were worth it to me. So as the years progressed, we got our own office. We got a permit from the city, which the owner paid for. We were able to open up almost like 3,000 square foot office in the hotel, which probably hasn't been done anywhere in the country, so that we can one-on-one with people, advocate people that were staying at the hotel. During the winter, it does peak. In the summer, it goes down a little bit. But we try to give everybody a chance, even if it's a second chance. Sometimes people come in with demons that or addictions that they're battling, and sometimes it takes more than one time to get them to where they need to be. As the time progressed, we started negotiations trying to buy the hotel, and it just kind of deteriorated. And as it went downhill, we were asked to leave. When we started there were 26 rooms that were available to rent. When we left, there were 101. So just like with people, I wanted that place left better than when I got there. And I feel we did. I think we helped with the fire suppression system. We helped with room renovations. We helped with grounds and things that it needed. If it wasn't going to pass an inspection, they told us, and we tried our best to make it happen. Brought in contractors and volunteers to try to better the place.
It came time where you had to leave that facility. How did Homeless Angels wind up at the Berkwood Inn on Lansing Road?
Well, one day someone came to me. They asked me if I would like this hotel. And we talked about what we needed to do to make this happen. We started a transitional team to go from the Magnuson to here. Got manuals together and came to an agreement with the Angel loaner, we'll call him, or donor. And the hope is in 4 years that this will be ours. And then we can use that equity, or we can use that money that we save and put it into another hotel in another city.
When you shut down the operation on the south side of Lansing, how many people were you housing there then? How many of those people maybe moved here at that time?
At the very end, there were about 6 chronically homeless, the hardest to place. Most of them went to the Volunteers of America's hotel program, and one of them went here, came here. All of them are housed right now.
They've all found permanent housing.
Permanent supportive housing.
So are you currently housing people here at the Berkwood that had been homeless?
Yes. There was 230 safe sleeps in 3 weeks this month.
What kind of shape was this building in? I assume you had to do some work on it. I'm curious whether people who had been homeless were involved in helping fix the building up, maybe.
Right now, we didn't have, at that time when we first got possession of the hotel, there was no homeless here. We had the workers that were here, which came under the new company, the new hotel, and they helped us. We worked with community organizations like the state police were just here. They came in and did community projects to help us gut the basement and clean things up. There was a lot of clutter here. There's a lot of old furniture that has never gotten rid of. We need to make some updates. But other than that, it's a fully functioning hotel. It just needs to be spiced up and given some love. That's all.
Speaking of giving a space some love, tell me about the room we're in right now. You used the word clutter. I'm going to say it's a bit cluttered, but it's a good kind of clutter. Tell me about this room.
It is. This is the old Berkwood office. We use this as our meeting room for families. But because the build-out isn't complete here at the Berkwood, where we have a room for Christmas, this has become the Christmas room. Last year, we helped around 1,400 kids in the community, local schools, and fire departments and police stations that have called us last year. We're doing the same thing this year. The only difference is because we don't have the space, we're not going to open it up to the public again. We're just going to help local police departments, local schools, local fire departments, local churches, or someone that may come at the last minute and say, you know what, my kid doesn't have Christmas, so we're going to make it happen if we can.
I'm seeing primarily a lot of dolls. You have a lot of nice presents for children here right now.
Yep, everything in this room is new. And we some of these gifts are for the families that are in the hotel right now. Some of them are for local schools, the local homeless liaisons. A lot of people don't realize that in each school there's a homeless liaison. Last year there were at least 600 kids in the Lansing School District that were documented homeless. So for a little child or a small child to get a new Barbie that they wouldn't have gotten is an amazing experience, and we're glad that we can make that happen.
We're talking with Mike Carl of the Homeless Angels about their new operation at the Berkwood Inn on Lansing Road in Lansing. Is this still within the city limits, the Berkwood Inn?
No, it's not. It's in Lansing Township, but we're willing to work with the Lansing. We love our city. We still categorize ourselves as in the city. Literally, it's closer for me to load up the van now and drive downtown and give out hats and stuff like that. So it's a great location. I think it's amazing.
When you first came to our attention, Mike, it was with outreach programs in the middle of the night in the city of Lansing, going around making sure people had food, helping them find shelter, possibly blankets, that kind of thing. Are you still doing that kind of work, too?
Yep, I still do that at least once a week or in the middle of the night if I get a call from the police officer or someone that needs help. I'll go. That's the primary where my heart is helping people out on the streets. I think my gift is I'm able to walk the streets of Detroit, Flint, Lansing, because I've been there and I can talk to people. It's not always safe, and I don't suggest anybody else do it, but that's what God laid on my heart, and that's what I must do.
I'm not sure everyone is familiar with your own personal story. Were you ever homeless yourself?
I was. I was homeless almost 13 years ago now, and I on the same streets here in Lansing. And it took someone doing what I do to get me out of that hole. I had a full-time job. I was at risk of losing my job. I was addicted to alcohol. I would drink a fifth a day. And it took someone with a simple meal and a conversation to get me into a hotel, put me in for 30 days, and make me realize that my life had value. And that's what's important, is showing that everyone has value.
On my way here to the Berkwood Inn, I took the route a lot of people would take, I assume, which is 496 to the Lansing Road exit, and zoom, I'm here in your parking lot pretty much. It struck me that on foot, this would be a bit difficult to reach for some people. How or can you help homeless people who I assume in at least some cases also have transportation issues? How do they get here?
Well, one of the things that we're working on right now with CATA is to put a stop out in front of the hotel. There is one on the number 7 bus line, I do believe, but it stops at 7 p.m. We want to somehow work with them to better the route here, because every day we get 50 to 60 people that stop in, walk in, and come for help, and we want to make it more accessibility to get here and help. So we do want to reach out to other organizations that might have transportation that or might have bus passes or CATA tokens that can help us get people out here. But it is a bit of a hike, but it's closer to downtown than the Magnuson was. So it, literally, if you go up St. Joe and you come across, it's right here. It's hard getting under that bridge, but there is a place in the park over there that we found that you can cross the tracks and get over. So it's complicated, but we're working on it.
I think that a lot of people in the Lansing area, their only observation of homeless people, or at least people who claim to be homeless, I suppose, in some cases, are the people with signs at highway exits and on certain street corners. Is that in any fashion part of your outreach, people who are doing that?
We do. We just lost a member of that's homeless that used to be panhandling, that everybody, I'm sure, he was on Cedar and Edgewood. His name was Tim. He struggled with alcohol for many years, and he had a stroller. First time I met him, he pulled a knife on me, and we built that friendship. And he started telling me about his knife and his fears and his anxiety and his alcohol addiction. Met with us many times. He stayed with us over the winter, but I could not get to that point where I could get him the help he needed. And he passed away on the 18th. The point of taking a minute just to learn people's stories, people's names. You don't have to give them money. Give them food. Make sure they have a full belly. Ask them their story. There may be someone looking for them. And Tim had a family. He had people that loved him. I loved him. And I think that his story needs to be told. As hard as it is for me to handle the pain of him dying and me sharing his story, maybe there's someone else that's struggling with addiction, someone else that has given up on someone that is addicted. Don't give up. Please keep going and help them. Their life has value.
Mike, you've just spoken with great emotion, and it leads me to ask you a question. Maybe not so much a question, a statement, that I'll bet this place in your operation sees lots of tears. Some of them are tears of sadness. Hopefully some are also tears of joy.
Yeah, I think no tear is wasted. Every tear has a purpose. And sometimes breaking down those barriers start people crying. But there's a lot of tears of joy here too. So we just take it day by day. We try to help as many people as we can. Of course, we found that we can't help everyone, but we try.
Mike Carl of the Homeless Angels. Thank you for everything you do for the homeless people of the Lansing area.
Thank you so much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Scott, what can people do to help the Homeless Angels now?
Well, Mike Carl tells me that their biggest needs are things like toilet paper, personal hygiene products, microwavable meals, and of course, money for their building fund. Mike showed me around, and there's a ton of usable space at the Burkwood Inn, but the place needs a lot of work. They'll take donations at the door, and we'll link to their website, homelessangels.org, where you can get more information or pitch in.
Thanks, Scott. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It was the most comfortable win of the season for the Detroit Lions as they beat the New Orleans Saints on the road 28-13 yesterday. Get this, the win was the Lions' first in a road game following Thanksgiving since 1974. Detroit sits at 8-4, has a golden opportunity to finish out their year strong and possibly host an NFL playoff game. Imagine that. Current sports host Al Martin joins us now in the studio to chat about that dream as well as a weekend recap of MSU hoops, volleyball, thoughts on the college football playoff rankings. Hi, Al.
How you doing, Mark? A lot going on.
There is. The Lions finally gave us a game in which we didn't need to see Matthew Stafford pull off some last. I was a little let down, actually.
I'm sure, right?
No last-minute fireworks for the Lions. How encouraging was this win?
Yeah, thank goodness the Lions, they've aged all Lions fans about 10, 15 years this entire year put together, right, Mark? But finally, as you put, finally a game where you just got to sit back, enjoy the fourth quarter and come back with the Lions win, right? I mean, Matthew Stafford, you mentioned him, Mark. I mean, he's been fantastic. 341 yards on Sunday. Two TDs. Four opportunities, though. What really surprised me in this game, they had four opportunities in the red zone, in the Saints' 20-yard line or in, where they didn't come away with a TD. All four were Matt Prater field goals. But other than that, I mean, you look at the entirety of the offensive production for the Honolulu Blue. Golden Tate has really come along as the season has progressed here, Mark. He's showing why he is one of the best receivers in the league. Actually leads the league in yak yards after catch. He had eight catches, 145 yards yesterday, had a 66-yard TD early in the fourth, and the Lions only led by 6 points. So that was the moment for me, Mark, that really cemented that win and made fans kind of take a deep breath and say, all right, I think the Lions have this one in the bag. But for me, the big thing here was the Lions defense, Mark. That was the reason why the Lions were able to pull out this win. And actually, the Lions became the first team in 60 Saints home games to stop Drew Brees from completing a touchdown pass.
Is the Lions defense improving? I mean, the Saints have a really potent offense.
Certainly. Without a doubt. I think that's a no-brainer. And I think a lot of that has to do with Terrell Austin, defensive coordinator for the Detroit Lions. He's been absolutely fantastic. He's doing it without any of the starting linebackers that we saw at the start of this year. He's doing it without a 100% healthy and sackless, mind you, Ziggy Ansah. We're seeing other players step up here. And in the Saints, I mean, this is a high-powered offense, Mark. Coming into this game, the number one ranked offense in the entire league. They score 49 points against the ninth-ranked L.A. Rams coming into this matchup the week prior to. And you look at the numbers for that defense for the Saints, Mark. I mean, you know, you look at 422 yards compared to 369 for the Saints. That tied the lowest offensive output all year for the Saints. Mm. And Drew Brees, not one, not two, but three INTs. No one could have fathomed that coming down the pike for this team on Sunday.
What has to happen for the Lions to host their first playoff game since whenever?
Yeah,
93.
It's a long time, Mark. And for me, I think that the magic number is 10 right now. You know, you look at, you know, the win against the Saints. The Lions currently sit at 8-4. two games better than the Green Bay Packers and the Minnesota Vikings, who are also, of course, in the NFC North. Both of those teams have a record of 6-6, Mark. So let's look at the schedule. They will play the Chicago Bears, which ousted the San Francisco 49ers pretty handily on Friday. That they will host the Bears this weekend. They play the New York Giants and the Dallas Cowboys, both on the road, then come back home to host the Green Bay Packers, a team that previously beat this squad earlier this season. So they'll be looking for some revenge in that game. If they come out with just two of the next four, they will sit at 10, and no one will catch the Lions. And a big thing here, I mean, we've seen the Lions make the playoffs under Jim Caldwell, but the thing is they have not hosted a playoff game. Mm-hmm. Home field advantage is the key, one of the big keys to success in the postseason. The Lions have a golden opportunity to do just that.
Let's transition to college here. The college football playoff rankings were finally revealed. Did the committee get it right?
Oh, they nailed it. They shocked me, I must say, Mark, because I had talked about on Current Sports last week how I wouldn't be surprised because of the mighty dollar. Whether or not, you know, Michigan got in or not, I was leaning towards Michigan possibly getting in, but they would have needed some help. Clemson handled business and won the ACC championship, so that cemented Clemson in there. Ohio State, they've been in the top four through the majority of the entire season, and especially in the most recent pre-ranking polls leading up to the final one that we saw on Sunday. Washington, that was the thing for me. And a lot of people will make this argument. You know, they look at the final rankings with Alabama 1, Clemson 2, OSU 3, and Washington 4. How does an Ohio State team that didn't win the Big Ten Conference title get in over a team that did, who also beat them in the head-to-head matchup, that being Penn State? The big thing there is the resume. Ohio State has bigger wins than the Penn State Nittany Lions over the course of the year. Also, Washington had a, you look at the record here. Washington had a better record at 12-1 than Penn State did at 11-2. However, Washington did play a horrendous non-conference schedule, one that actually ranks second to worst in the nation, Mark. So at the end of the day, though, for me, I thought that the College Football Playoff Committee knocked it out the park. They stayed true to what they're about, and they put in the right personnel.
Was there any chance Michigan would land a spot? And how do Wolverine fans feel about the Citrus Bowl against Florida State?
Well, they're going to feel a little salty, without a doubt. I've seen it on social media already as soon as the rankings were announced. But when Clemson topped Vitek over the weekend, it was a no-brainer for me. You know, you knew that Clemson was getting in, and then Washington moving to 12-1, that was also a no-brainer. They get to go and play in the Citrus Bowl. They will play a really good Florida State team. And I'm just glad that the committee did not sell out here, Mark, because I thought that Washington deserved it over U of M.
Who wins it all?
Oh, Alabama. That's a no-brainer. Everybody knows it. Nick Saban is the highly favored guy in this whole spiel.
The MSU men's basketball team hosted Oral Roberts on Saturday, getting a win that moved them a game over 500. Why was Tom Izzo so displeased afterwards?
Very displeased, Mark. I mean, you would have thought that Tom Izzo lost the game if you would have listened to his post-game rant. Again, a win is a win, but the way Tom Izzo looks at wins is different than reporters or you and I would, right? They won by 4 points, and they let Oral Roberts score 76 that entire game. The defensive effort was not there, and Tom Izzo went on to say in an epic, and I do mean epic, post-game rant, which we'll play later on this afternoon on Current Sports, Mark. He says that, quote, "We did not play hard enough, and we did not play smart enough." Now, granted, Nick Ward, 24 points, 10 rebounds, his first double-double of his career, Cassius Winston, both coming off the bench. Cassius Winston with 15 points, 9 assists, 4 rebounds. Great. And the bench outscored Oral Roberts, actually get this, 56-0. But when it comes to the defensive effort, that's what I think Tom Izzo was talking about here. You can't make a play on offense and then take plays off. He was not happy about that. And there were a few questions that got under Tom Izzo's skin on Saturday afternoon, and he bit back and said, you know what, I'm not changing the way I coach. I'm coaching these guys tough, and we're going to practice two, maybe even three times on Sunday. Whoa. So it's all about ironing out the wrinkles right now, and Tom Izzo knows how urgent this period is, especially with the absence of Miles Bridges.
What is the update on Miles Bridges?
Yeah, right now, Miles is day-to-day. You know, Izzo announced last week during practice that Miles will be out at the least a couple of weeks. I saw him one on Saturday. He does have a boot in that left ankle right now, but he is walking around. He's ditched the crutches, so that's a good thing. And the good thing is he didn't break it. You know, it looks like maybe a severe ankle sprain, but he'll be back, I think, in time for Big Ten play, Mark.
We got 30 seconds, Al, but we want to talk briefly about the MSU women's volleyball team eliminated from the NCAA's second round over the weekend. What do you make of the season?
Yeah, I was there, and it was a great atmosphere, and for Michigan State to host the first NCAA volleyball championship for that program since 2003 was fantastic. A historic year, you know, 13 Big Ten wins, most in the Kathy George era. Winning a season in 20 years, going 24-8, nonetheless, a great year despite being eliminated in the second round. Mark, we'll have more on that this afternoon as well.
Al Martin of Current Sports here on WKAR. Thanks, Al.
Thank you, Mark. Anytime.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, MSU sports fans fondly remember the national football championship teams in the mid-60s. Less well-remembered is a national championship for Spartan wrestling. In 1967, Scott Pohl talks with a member of that team, Dale Anderson, about his book telling the team's story, Miracle on the Mat. And some of the world's greatest musicians are bringing the best of Johann Sebastian Bach to the Wharton Center. We'll speak with a member of New York's Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center about this Thursday's concert. That and more Tuesday here on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, everything we do on this program, ends up on the podcast. Check it out. Informative, insightful, indispensable, with environmental news, Michigan politics and education, Michigan government, health care, sports, music and theater. Stories from around the state in your hometown, the Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you have a great day. I'm Mark Bayshore. See you Tuesday on Current State.